There's a lot to say when buying a new home or car, but only one thing to say that can help you protect them. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, a State Farm agent will be there to help you choose the coverage you need, no matter where you are in life. When you need coverage options, your State Farm agent is there to help, on the phone or in person. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 596. I'm sitting here in the Nerdist Podcast office? Studio? What is this room, Katie?
It's a studio.
It's not really, though. It's an office that we've squatted.
Yeah. I would call it a studio, though.
So do you think anywhere you can set up a microphone is a studio, or do you think a studio has to be designed as a studio?
Okay, I guess it's a room. We did put up a few things of egg crate. The rest fell.
There are egg crates up. This episode is our pal Peter Farrelly, who... I think we mentioned this on the podcast. He actually announced Dumb and Dumber 2, that it was being done on this very podcast a while ago. And, of course, a lot of other news sources took credit for it, but it happened here first. Sorry for being passive-aggressive. But, yeah, so Pete came back on. Dumb and Dumber 2 is out this Friday, November 14th. Harry, Lloyd, back. Rob Riggle, back. Our new pal Rachel Melvin, in. She's great in it. Kathleen Turner, in. It's a fun movie and you should go watch it. Even if you never saw the original Dumb and Dumber, you could still go. Or you could watch it and then go watch the sequel again. But really fun. And Pete's the nicest guy in the world.
He really is.
He's such a sweet guy. So here we go, the Nerdist Podcast number 596 with Peter Farrelly.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
So we're both right. No, actually, you're right. That's where he was born. That's what you said.
You guys are arguing about
right,
Michael
I'm
Chiklis
wrong.
Was born?
Yes. We're very competitive.
How long did that go on? Notable.
About a half hour.
We're just discussing notable people from Lowell, Massachusetts, which I am fortunate enough to be on that
you
Wikipedia
and Michael Chiklis.
List. Me, Michael Chiklis, Ed McMahon.
Oh.
Olympia Dukakis. Mickey Ward, of course.
Jack Kerouac.
Okay.
Yeah.
You've heard of him.
Yeah. Anyone else?
Oh, hang on, I'll look.
Okay.
Notable residents, guys.
Jack Kerouac's got like the saddest death of you know those people. He was at his mother's house, living with his mother down in Florida, and he just keeled over drinking at like 10:30 in the morning.
Oh, that was it?
Yeah, he was like 46 or something.
Jesus.
It's a sad ending for a guy. Like, you know, he was such a, you know, his books are so... alive.
Kerouac, you know? Ed McMahon, Betty Davis, Michael Chiklis, Nancy Kelly, Olympia Dukakis, Michael Ansara, Matt Myra, Michael Casey, George Washington Dixon, I don't know who that is, Mike Goddard of Lost in Space, Ray Goulding of Bob and Ray.
You listened to Lowell Talk with Matt fucking Myra.
Welcome to Talking to Lowell, Matt Myra.
Hey,
looks like Nicholas A. Besbains, author, cultural historian. He wrote Gentle Madness.
Oh, I was wondering where that guy was born. Yeah. Now I can sleep tonight.
Yeah.
I've had a lot of insomnia over that.
Yeah, I like how you guys begin your show. Like, is there an actual beginning?
No,
or
there's
just
never a beginning.
No, I mean, it's not like, hey, how you doing? We're back. It's just like, it's just like it's endless. It just...
Yes,
it's
like the universe. There are some strong theories about how it started, but no one's exactly sure.
Yeah, but I've been here about 45 minutes, and we've been talking. Like, we've already covered all the good shit.
Did it.
That was it?
Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
What? Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah. This is the easiest podcast ever. You know, it's nice and circular to have you on because you announced Dumb and Dumber 2 when you came on the podcast.
That's right.
Ages ago.
Yes. And by the way, as you know, I invited you to come to the set and be in Dumb and Dumber 2.
You did not.
I totally did.
No, yeah, you
did.
Said...
No, it's on the tape.
Yeah. No, no.
What you said was, oh, come down and podcast the guys.
During the production, I had them contact you, say, please come by, and we would love to put you in it.
No one told me that.
Okay, then Ellen's fired.
No.
She said, no, he can't do it. I said, really? Because... You know, it would be great to have him on here. I swear to God.
I would have loved to have done that.
Okay, is there a phone?
Wow. No, yes.
Let's call this
Listen,
number.
First of all.
I want her to explain. I'm telling you, like.
I believe you because you're a man of your word.
I try to get you in the movie.
I wanted to be in the movie.
I wanted you. I was shocked that you said no.
I didn't say no.
Now, if you'd asked me, I'm from Lowell. I would have come by.
Ellen, you there?
No, it's still ringing.
Hey, Ellen, how you doing? It's Pete. I'm sitting here with Chris Hardwick. How's
hey,
it
Ellen,
going?
How's it going?
Hey, Chris, how are you?
Good. Now, Pete was just telling a tale that you had reached out to someone to ask me to be in Dumb and Dumber 2, and someone told you that I said no. Is that true?
You did not say no. You were not available, I believe, at the time, but you did not say no.
When was this? No one even asked me. So it went to someone who said, oh, he's not available. And that didn't even trickle down to me.
Yeah.
I would have forcibly shoved that into the calendar. But I'm so sorry, Ellen.
No, that's okay. I'm pretty sure we spoke on the phone.
Oh, boy.
Speak on the phone about it.
No? I believe Ellen.
No, wait. We spoke on the phone, but all you said was, Pete wants to know if you want to drop by the set. And I said, oh, I'm working this date. But no one ever said, do you want to be in the movie? That is a much different conversation.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay. Well, in any case, I just want to know I wasn't bullshitting him. I tried to get him in here.
Yes, you did. You and I did speak, Ellen. Now I do remember this. But you said, hey, we're just in Pete. Yes, and you said, "Do you want to drop by the set?" And I said, "I'm so sorry, I'm shooting that day, but if I had known that was the deal to be in a Farrelly Brothers movie, I would have moved the other thing. But I thought it was just like, oh, drop by and visit. And I always feel weird about set visits anyway.
No,
I feel like I'm in the way.
Those are I mean that I wanted. What were we reshooting? Do you remember, Ellen? Oh, okay, yeah. So, yes, there was a little scene where we could have put you in. I said you would probably love to be in there, so that's what I was trying to do. But no big deal.
That would have been amazing.
We'll do the next
one.
Please, Dumb and Dumber 4, F-O-R.
Thank you. Thanks, Ellen.
Okay, thanks, Ellen.
No worries. Thanks, bye.
Okay.
Bye. Poor Ellen is like, what the fuck did I
no,
just get sucked
she,
into?
No, she should be learning a lesson here that she didn't clarify. You're like, you gotta clarify.
It sounded to me like, hey, do you want to just drop by the set? And so that was difficult to cancel work for. But if I,
okay, let me tell you, one of the worst things that ever happened to me and still eats at me at 3 o'clock in the morning is this. One time I was in my office and we used to let friends use my room. We have a big, conference room.
Yeah.
And friends would call and they don't have offices. Hey, can I use your conference room? I got a big meeting. I say, sure. They come on in and they do it, right? And this one guy had called me, a good friend of mine, Rob Moran, and my brother-in-law, Zan Gessner, they were trying to get a movie made of The Comedy Writer, which is a book I wrote. And I told them, they said, can we make this? Do you want to make it? I said, I really don't have any interest, but if you got run with it, if you can set it up, you can have it, right? So one day they come in, they say, hey, there are these guys in the other room. This is probably like 10, 12 years ago. Can you just come in and say hi? I said, yeah, absolutely. So I go in there and there's guys, they're like, this is, Judd, and this is this guy, and this is that guy. Yeah. And I shake hands, and I say, how you guys doing? And they say, great. Now, by the way, needless to say, this was Judd Apatow.
Right.
Now, this is before, like, 40-year-old version, before his career, like, he was always around.
Right.
But I didn't know him, but I knew of him.
This is post Freaks and Geeks.
Yes, but I didn't know what he looked like.
Right.
And until, now everybody knows what he looks like, but this was before then, but I'd heard of him since I got out here. I remember when he did Cable Guy. I mean, everybody was like, he's behind Cable Guy. You know, he never got credited and apparently should have. But in any case, he was a guy who I was well aware of for many years as being one of the the top comedy writers in the town, but I didn't know what he looked like. So this happened, and I just went, hey guys, how's it going? Boom, 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 and then I went back to work. And I'm telling you the truth, 5 years later, Rob says to me, man, it's too bad that Judd Apatow didn't do your book. And I said, yeah, that would have been great. He says, but we got close with him. I said, when? He says, remember when he was in the office and you met with him? I said, I never met with Judd Apatow in my office. I would remember that. He goes, no, you met with him in the office. I said, when? He says, remember we had this meeting and I said, come on and say hi. He said, you didn't say it was Judd Apatow. You said some guy, Judd. I didn't know that. If you had said the name Apatow, I would have been like, you're fucking kidding me. You got Judd Apatow? I mean, this is before his huge success. But
there are
when
only
he was.
Two male Judds in this town.
Yeah, but when he, when yeah, but
no, there's three.
No, there's Judds here and there, but
there's Judd Hirsch and there's Judd Nelson.
No,
yeah,
yeah. Nelson.
I was, but the fact of the matter is, like, I knew the name Apatow. Every writer in town knew of him well before he was a huge success, and I would have not left that room until he signed on the dotted line. You got to do this, man. And anyway,
there's also Ashley Judd.
Yeah.
Well,
and Winona Judd.
They're just.
And Naomi Judd.
That's the thing. Like, I always think.
Wait, maybe he'll do it now.
But what a turd he must think I was. Like, I come in, hey, man, how you doing? How's it going? And then walk out. But, you know, not that I shouldn't have treated anybody well, but I didn't know it was Judd Apatow, and I would have been a little more attentive.
I'm sure you were nice to him. I'm sure
I was fine.
The only thing you didn't do was force a pen in his hand and say, sign this.
Well, I would have, like, said, like, fuck, man, I'm a huge fan. Like, I knew Cable Guy. I knew all the shit he did, but I just didn't know what he looked like. No one said, Judd Apatow. He says, come on in. There's a couple guys in the room. And it was like, hey, this is Steve. This is Judd. This is Joe. Hey, guys, how you doing? What's up? How's it going? Yeah, we're talking about this thing. Well, good luck. See ya.
That was a fun sketch on SNL, by the way, of this Carrey family reunion where everyone did all of the characters at Jim Carrey that I'm sure everyone... Did you see it?
I did not see it.
No. Taron Killam did a fucking great...
Yeah,
Ace Ventura.
Yes,
and then someone, who was it? Was it? I can't remember who came up from behind the bar and did Cable Guy. It was like,
Keenan.
No, it wasn't Keenan. Was it Jay Farrow?
I don't know. I didn't see it.
Is Jay Farrow on the show now? Yeah. I think it might have been Jay. Does Jay do Obama?
Yes.
Yeah, it's Jay. Then Jay did the Cable Guy, and he basically made some joke about like. I wasn't popular at the time, but I'm a cult hit or something like that. Mm-hmm. It was really good. It was a fun nod.
Cable Guy's a very funny movie.
Yeah, it's still very funny. And it was it's one of those movies that's more enjoyable the more you see it. But the point is, like, there's a lot of like misunderstandings in this town. And I'll tell you one way I found out is because, we got passed on by at least 150 people, and I'm not exaggerating, 150 different actors passed on Dumb and Dumber, the first one. We were sending it everywhere, and nobody wanted to do it. They all passed. And over the years, I bumped into some of those people. And occasionally, I'll never bring it up, but occasionally they say, hey, how come you never offered me anything? I'm like, well, we did. You offered you Dumb and Dumber. And like, fuck you. I said, no, we did. None of them ever heard of it. They were never – what happens is you think they said no, but really their agents got the call and said, no, they're going
to
pass.
Well, that's why I thought maybe Ellen – I'd forgotten Ellen and I spoke. I thought she maybe talked to someone – because sometimes what will happen is – someone will say, hey, can you do this thing? And someone who works for me will just look at my schedule and they'll go, oh, no, he's not available this day.
Yeah.
And so I always tell people, like, tell me what the thing is, and then I will decide.
Well, Chris, it clearly says here laundry, so you're busy.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad we clarified it before heads started rolling around here.
Yes, yes. Oh,
but I want to go past.
It was almost like a lotto machine of heads in here.
Chris,
like,
you said you didn't want to do it, remember?
And what if Ellen was like, you said you would never be seen with Pete Farrelly again.
Yeah, what the hell's going on?
I never... I'm sorry, bad connection.
Yeah. I thought you were just still reeling from movie 43 and just said, no, I'm not going on that fucking side. I'm not going near them. They're poison.
No, my God, please.
No, I do remember she said, no, I can't make it. I said, oh, I was surprised. I thought he'd want
to. Of course I would have wanted to.
Yeah, we're going to get you in there.
Spectacular miscommunication.
That is a great.
I love it.
Yeah.
Because you probably would have moved stuff.
I would have. Yeah. The only thing I can't move is at midnight shoot time.
You can move it. We moved it Tuesday.
If I have enough notice.
Yeah.
But I can't... If I have weeks, I can move a shoot time by like an hour.
Mm.
But if it's like a day or two before, then I can't move a shoot time. But I would totally have... listen, the next time, please.
Well, you're a busy guy. In fact, I was going to ask you. Are you a billionaire?
Not yet.
Because you're like, you know, Merv Griffin, like, you're on everything. I see you, like, you've got a lot going on,
there's
don't
stuff, you?
You
know, there's...
I can't, like, I pick a, like, sometimes I'm flipping around, like, you're on a show, like, where the fuck is this coming from? You're on so much stuff. You're, like, the go-to guy.
It's been fun. Yeah. And what's nice about it is just having so many years of not working at all, that it's sort of like, you know, when stuff comes along, and it, like, this would have been a perfect example of something that... You know, hey, that sounds fun. Like, that's what's... I only work on stuff that sounds fun to me.
I know, but I don't want to, like, you know, I'm sure this is embarrassing, but you are becoming iconic almost. Like, you're hitting big places at big times where I'm like, wow, this guy, you know, because I do remember you when you were on the red carpet, like, you know, just, hey, how you doing, people, man?
Yeah, I was doing the... Yeah, like,
but I knew you
Billy
before
Bush
that.
Thing.
I remember seeing you do stand-up.
Yeah, we talked about this on the podcast last time, that we met maybe at the Improv, I think. And then I saw you at Kevin James's house in, like, 2003.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
It was like a Thanksgiving thing. You were there.
Yeah, he's a good man. I like
Favreau
that guy.
Was there and a couple other people. I remember it pretty clearly.
Oh, he didn't know that. He thought it was just a guy named John and somebody named
Kevin. Really? That's Favreau? You got
to
be sure.
But what was so amazing, and I think I said this last time, when I saw you at Kevin's house, we had met, I'll tell you where we met. We met at Y107. You came in morning radio to promote There's Something About Mary.
Yeah.
And we met because you came on the show, and then I ran into you again at the Improv later. But that's where we first met.
Yeah, but I had seen you do stand-up before then.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
you didn't. We never met, but I was aware of you.
But then, but the funny part was you. I remember this so clearly. You describing There's Something About Mary before anyone else had seen it.
Yeah.
We were like, yeah, you know, it's just this crazy comedy, and we do a lot of stuff in there that no one's ever done. Like, there's a scene where we put cum in her hair, and like the thing that actually ends up becoming like one of the most iconic comedy things in a movie. I remember you very clearly before anyone knew what it was, just like, oh, we do this, and the movie's really crazy.
I specifically remember that interview, and I remember saying this to you. I remember saying, look, I don't know how it's going to do, but I know you're going to like it.
Yeah.
I know you're going to like it. I do remember that. I remember, look, you never know, because we didn't know. America might say, what are you, out of your fucking mind? That's awful. You know, that's terrible. You can't do that. We did not know. It wasn't out yet, but I knew you'd like it.
That's so great, and that was There's Something About Mary. Well done. Well done. But it's fun to be around long enough to, you know, just see, like, just, like, watch where people go and how they develop and what's been going on. Yeah. God damn, morning radio almost fucking killed me. That's like you're getting up at 3:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
And your day is, like, you've already had a full day by noon.
Yeah. I'm a night owl, so that would be... Like, this feels like morning to me.
I'm, like, crying thinking about that. Like,
Do you do it every morning?
No, I can't do that.
Yeah.
I don't want to do that.
Although Howard pulls it off. You know, Howard makes it...
Yeah, but he always will go, I'm so fucking tired. I'm so miserable. I mean, how much longer can I do this?
You know, even at this point...
He always says that.
Even at this point, if he just didn't do it anymore, he's done it for so long, he would instinctively just get up at that...
I'm sure.
Well, this is what, you know, now, because the truth is, you know, obviously I've known of Howard for 30 years, but I didn't start listening to Howard until 2 years ago when I got Sirius Radio, because I'm not an early bird. I'm never up in the morning, but I'd hear a story. But you hear what Howard did today, Howard did this. I was always a fan of Howard's. And in fact, I went to the premiere of his movie somehow in New York, and that's another story. But what I never met Howard, but just about 2 years ago got Sirius, and now it's on all day long.
Oh, it's so cool.
And I am a huge fan. Now I'm like, oh my God. When he does an interview, there's nothing better than Howard doing an interview. You know, when he's like, when they're bantering, they got an hour to kill, it's okay. I can listen. When he's doing an interview, he'll ask anything. Hey, you bang that chick?
Is that
the essential quality of Howard? Because there were so many Howard knockoffs after Howard that basically.
No, I think with Stern, the beauty of Stern is that he does a little bit of, like, bobbing and weaving before he takes a right, meaning that he sort of will ease people into being comfortable on that couch,
and then
because he has the time to do it.
And then he hits them with
that. And then he just asks the question that everyone is wondering and no one's ever asked
that
person.
And also, he's very disarming, too, because he just is like a dude.
Yeah,
he's very affable.
He just talks to you like a dude, and he's very He's very natural and
he's great.
And but the thing is, he is the original because when I lived in New York in the mid '80s. I was in grad school, and at the time I was just poor, living in a little hovel, broke, bartending. And I, my buddy was going out with one of the Coconuts from Kid Creole and the Coconuts. Remember the band?
Yes. Yeah.
It were the three girls.
Sure.
And they were the great. Coconuts? Oh, they were sensational. These three girls, the one I remember was Cheryl Poirier. She was sensational as a person, beauty, everything. And my buddy was going out with her. And so he would occasionally call me and say, hey, the Coconuts are playing down at the so-and-so. You want to come? So I'd, you know, they'd actually come by, pick me up in a limousine, you know, up in Harlem. And take me down there. It was great. And then we'd be backstage, we'd meet people. But they were the first ones that told me about Howard. They'd gone on Howard's show back then. And I don't remember where he was, but they're like, this guy is un-fucking believable.
Was it WN?
He is so funny. NBC. The shit he was asking, the way he was talking, it was groundbreaking stuff. Nobody had ever done anything like that. And that was, you know, and then that's been, you know, copied many, many times since. But he is
you still can't. Because, you know, for the longest time, all the Howard knockoffs would just, you know, just say like, hey, you banging that chick? But it wasn't, it's not organic. Like, he's so...
it feels like him.
It's him.
And other guys, like, when, you know, other guys did it, and I don't want to mention names, but it feels like they're trying to be...
They're doing an act.
They're trying to be Howard.
They're trying to be shocking, or they're trying to be provocative.
Howard's the real deal.
And also... he has the thing that I think is very important, which is you feel like he's your buddy because he opens up about himself. And I mean, like, he's pretty, seems pretty open.
I got to tell you, the small penis thing is fascinating to me. Like, he's like, at first I thought, well, it's just a joke. It's a nice way, self-deprecating. But now I'm thinking, is it really that small?
They measured it.
He seems to be too big. He's too tall. And he's Jewish.
And those are all, that's all the guys
not
on
known
staff.
For small penises.
All the guys on staff, Fred and Gary and Howard, they all measured.
Did they?
Yeah.
Full mast.
I feel like it was the early 2000s. I think when they got to satellite or right before. And I feel like Howard's was like just a little over six or something like that.
No.
Like it was like a normal size.
He's an average size penis.
Yeah, no.
He's such a tall man. He probably assumes it should be 9.5.
Yeah, he makes it seem like way smaller.
But I mean, I suppose in looking at him, it probably does look out of proportion.
So, by the way, when we went to, my wife and I went to the movie premiere, Howard's
Private Parts.
We got invited.
Which we know is 6 inches.
We went. We had a ball. And while there, we just had our first child, we had a little baby and boy. And when we were there, we saw Ron Jeremy, and we took a picture, me, my wife, and Ron between us. And we sent that to select friends that Christmas as our Christmas card. You know, Pete, Melinda, and the baby, Bob. Seriously, we sent that out to about 15 or 20 friends. the stocking and Yuletide stuff all around it. Yeah.
The hedgehog. He's still kicking around, isn't he?
Ron Jeremy sure is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Unfortunately,
is he still having sex with ladies on camera?
I believe he's still doing it. He had that heart attack situation.
Did he?
Couple months back.
Well, a dick that big requires a lot of blood.
I know. I think he pulled through. I still see him popping up in like weird B movies.
There you go. Yeah. He's always popping up in movies.
But the thing I like, you know, what you're saying about Stern is I like the stuff. Even when they don't have a guest, I could just listen to that show forever. Like, I love it when like a guest is supposed to come in and then doesn't show up or something like that, and then they have like the whole 4 hours where it's just talking to Fred and Robin and like taking calls from the Whack Pack. It's so fucking
funny. But when he hits somebody like somebody I'm really interested in, and he asks all the questions that I want. Like, he did an interview with Daryl Hall, this long interview that was just really great, like really great. Where I'm a huge Hall & Oates fan, you know, Abandoned Luncheonette. For people who don't know that album, by the way, that's early Hall & Oates. It's not the stuff like, you know, Man Eater and that stuff.
Right.
It's way before that. That's one of the top five favorite albums of all time. And the only one song you know on that is She's Gone. You know?
Yeah.
She's Gone. Oh, wow. That album, top to bottom, is as good as it gets. And I've been a fan of theirs since that album. But anyway, he got on and he was hitting them with questions and asking like where the songs came from. I could not get enough of it. I think I listened to it like 3 days in a row, make sure I heard correctly some of the answers. because you know they keep running them. You know,
well, we just had that Bill Murray interview that was awesome.
That was great.
Yeah,
I'm a big Hall & Oates fan too. By
Abandoned
the way.
Luncheonette. My wife, when I met my wife, I mentioned Hall & Oates. She, what? Are you kidding me? No, come on, because they were so poppy eventually. She thought that they, you know, it was like, you know, like when I mentioned Jay Giles, she was like, come on, give me a break. Centerfold? I said, no, no, no. I'm talking Full House Jay Giles. I'm talking Bloodshot Jay Giles. Early Jay Giles. Jay Giles, the album Full House is arguably the best live album of all time. It was picked that, it's been picked that many, you know. It's really an incredible album. And in any case, same thing with Hall & Oates. Like she was listening, she was thinking poppy Hall & Oates, Rich Girl, you know, which I happen to like that, but she thought they were a little, you know, too poppy.
They were great though.
But that early stuff they had was incredible.
Yeah, did you see them at the Hall of Fame? Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They just got inducted last year.
The Hall & Oates of Fame?
They did say that.
Good. Well, the funny part is that they got inducted, but on Howard's show, Daryl Hall was saying, fuck them. I don't give a fuck if I ever get in the Hall of Fame, assholes. I thought, uh-oh, he'll never get in now. And he did. You know, yeah. But it took a few years.
That's deserved it. What?
They deserved it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. Questlove inducted them.
Oh, did he really?
Yeah, Philly.
Oh,
that's nice. He's from Philly.
Yeah. He always hated, like, Daryl, this is the thing, like, he hated the blue-eyed soul tap. You know, they were called blue-eyed soul. He said, that is so insulting. That's so racist. He goes, why can't it just be soul?
Yeah.
We were soul singers. Blue-eyed soul makes it seem like it's soul light, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. We're soulless. Yeah. You blue-eyed soulless. Motherfuckers.
I did see them on tour when I was in grade school. Like, I can't remember what tour it was. But it was way into the poppy stuff.
Yeah.
It was way, 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 way into the poppy stuff.
Well, it's like I saw, I was at Bonnaroo this year, and I saw Elton John played, and he was amongst many, many great bands. But Elton John played, and the first half of his thing was, it was unbelievably good. He was playing, like, you know, Yellow Brick Road and all the early stuff.
Yeah.
And then, unfortunately, the second half, he's into, like, Philadelphia Freedom and, you know, other things that were just poppy, not as good, you know, as his early stuff. And the second half of the show, for me, was sort of downhill. But the audience was like, yay! You know, they hear something. But
I saw him and Billy Joel do that face-to-face tour where they both had their pianos up on stage, full band. It was fucking awesome.
Yeah.
Because they would each, like, come out and do a crazy hit and play together and then Billy would sing a Elton John song and then reverse. Elton would sing a Billy Joel song. It was
I
want to
see that.
It was awesome.
Is there a concert film of that somewhere?
Oh, there must be, right? They sell anything.
I like the deep tracks. You know, like I like if I'm seeing Bruce, I like to hear the stuff off Asbury Park and The Wild and the Innocent, first couple albums. But he'll play a couple off of those, but he won't go deep in them because he's got so many hit songs that people want to hear. And it's, you know, I like hearing
a guy that can play 50 different songs and they're all hits.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So that's that gets tougher.
He's
not like one of these like Spin Doctors types that has to close and open with two princes.
So what's your favorite deep cut Billy Joel song?
That's a good question.
I personally don't know his deep cuts.
What about Elton John?
Elton John would be like, you know, stuff off Madman Across the Water, and you know there's a bunch of little songs on there, and like for Bruce, for instance, like I love, you know, well, I wouldn't say Rosalita's a deep one, but you know, the early stuff, the Meeting Across the River is on the other one, or is it, you know, just the stuff that you don't hear on the radio anymore. Yeah. Like, you know, that's the thing. I remember when, you know, I was into Bruce early from Greetings from Asbury Park, and then he did The Wild and the Innocent, and he was unknown. I mean, people still didn't know him. He had a small following in the Northeast. But when he was on the cover, when Born to Run came out, he was on the cover of Time and Newsweek the same week. It's the first time any non-political figure was ever on the cover of Time and Newsweek the same week. And he exploded, and I remember being sick to my stomach about it. I was like,
You thought you lost him?
Yeah. It's like seeing your girlfriend on the cover of Time and Newsweek. It's like, oh, my God, they all know. It's done.
So you did you feel like you appreciated him less after that, or you just had to share him with people that you didn't really like?
I just didn't like to share him. No, I appreciate him just as much, and later albums were probably better. Like, you know, Like I love the river, and you know, he had so many.
So when people come up and be like, "Have you heard this Bruce Springsteen?" You're like, "I know, I know."
Yeah. Now I was a little covetous of him. Like he was like our guy, and we saw him at the Palace. You know, he would play at the Palace in Providence, and it would be like 2,000 people. And it was just the best show ever, and yeah, it was just sad to see him. It was a weird feeling to see him get so big, but. Still love him. Love everything about him. He's the only guy I've ever met who I cannot talk around.
Oh, really?
Too nervous?
Yeah, I can't talk. I can't speak. My wife, like, I met him a couple times at places.
Do you know where he was like, "Hey, man, I liked it when you put that cum in that girl's hair."
Yeah. Well, he actually did do that. He said, like, "Hey, you're the Dumb and Dumber guy. Hey, let me get my kids." He pulled his kids over. "Hey, kids, this is the Dumb and Dumber guy." I was just standing there. All I want to say is, like, fucking love you, man. You fucking changed my life, man. My high school, I wouldn't have had it without you, man. You know, like, I don't know what to say. And yeah. My wife, like, I've come up, my wife doesn't give a shit. And she's like, "Hey, how you doing, Bruce? How are you doing, Melinda?" And then after, she's, "What's the matter with you?" I said, "I can't talk around him. I just can't do it." By the way, I've met presidents.
Sure.
And I'm like, hey, what's up? How you doing, man? Bruce... Yeah. I know for a fact that Bruce thinks I'm a complete asshole because I've met him probably 3-4 times now, and I'm always a complete imbecile.
No, maybe he thinks you're cool. He's like, "Hey, man, that Pete Farrelly's pretty cool around me. I want to know what makes him tick."
Yeah. I really don't. I think he thinks, "Wow, this is an odd dude." Because he did one nice thing which is I saw him somewhere, and I just watched his VH1 special. Storytellers yep. thing mm-hmm. where he gets up and he sings a song acoustically and then he explains the song, which is spectacular. And I'd come home at like 2 a.m. I was out and flipped on the TV and it was just beginning. I was like, "Oh, fuck." So I watched the whole thing till like 4 a.m. And he says, like, you know, Indians in the summer, Indians, that was my little league baseball team. Really? You know, that kind of shit, explaining all the songs. And I saw him somewhere and I went over, I said, I saw your VH1 thing, man. I couldn't turn it off. I came home 2 a.m, I was exhausted, and I watched it till 4 a.m, it was so good. And about a week later, I got a little package at my office from Bruce Springsteen.
What?
He said, "Here's a few more things that we cut out of it, the extended version." He says, "Great seeing you, you know, Bruce."
Oh, come on!
That's awesome.
I framed it. The letter, the note that he sent me.
How long did it take you to come down from that?
Well, that's Bruce. I mean, Bruce is, you know, there's few people on the planet that you feel like are like higher beings. And Bruce is that kind of guy. Like, it's not just the music. It's the way everything, like, I agree with every damn thing that comes out of his mouth. Like, whenever he's behind a cause, I'm behind that cause. And it's not because he's behind it. It's like he never is off. Like, he never says, like, you know, something like, "What? Like, you know, I'm against gay marriage." And, like, that would be a bummer. You know, like, "Why are you against gay
marriage?" Oh, that'd be awful.
Marriage. You know, but, like, he'll never hit you with something that's shocking and disturbing. He always, his heart is, in my mind, always in the right place. Like, you know, like, I don't give a I'm glad people, I want gay people to be able to get married. Why shouldn't they be able to get married? You know, if they're in love, get married. What's the big deal? Let's do it, right? We want happiness in this world. And if you're keeping them from being, well, that's Bruce's thing. Bruce is like, he's just to be around him, you could feel it.
Wants everyone to be happy.
He's an old soul.
Well, and, you know, Bruce and Howard, I'm really interested in guys who are able to stay relevant and on top of their game for 30, 40, you know, 50 years to be able to maintain a certain level and never veer off or never lose focus. Because it's easy to do that. It's hard. It's very difficult to stay on track. And somehow, you know, there's something about these types of people that, you know, they don't. Once they hit it, they don't go crazy, or they don't, or they're, at least they're able to contain it.
Yeah,
and they don't waver, you know. After all those years.
When guys are true to themselves, you know it, and you know. But that's not saying Bruce hasn't made mistakes in his life. Yes, because they're all human, and I'm sure he's made a million mistakes. But he's just got a good soul, and you know.
If I knew the name of a Bruce Springsteen album, that would have been my joke there.
Born in the USA.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. He never made a mistake except for Born in the USA.
Yeah.
Well, I don't.
You know, Bruce is one
I never got into the boss. I don't know why.
You came in late. You're too young.
You came in.
No, you came in late.
I think I came in slightly too late,
yeah.
Too, because, you know, my first exposure to Bruce Springsteen was Dancing in the Dark on MTV, because that's the exact age that I was,
right.
And that's where I would have found him.
Right.
And
well, it's probably
is Courtney Cox.
I'm sure you like this guy, but you probably don't understand him as much as someone who came up with him, Bob Dylan.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Now, Dylan and Dylan and Springsteen, they have similar in this way that Dylan broke a ground, like there was nothing like Dylan. He was suddenly telling these long songs, telling these long stories in song, and it was like, you know, basically like a Pete Seeger type thing or a Woody Guthrie, but he was doing it in a not just an acoustic way. He went electric and he did all sorts of stuff, and you know, he changed. Nobody had done that, right? And that's what Bruce did. See, 1973, 74, 75, when I'm in high school, that was a shitty time for music. 60s and early 70s were great, but all of a sudden, literally, Disco Duck was all over the radio. and
Rick Dees!
It was horrible. Like, that was like the number one song, and like number two was like Neil Sedaka. And there was a bunch of shit on this music. And all of a sudden, this guy comes out of nowhere. And what he did is, it was sort of, to me, it was like a mixture of Dylan and Van Morrison, where he combined like a Dylan kind of like storytelling thing where he would ramble on, and then he threw horns in there, and it the first minute I heard him, I was madly in love with that sound, and it changed everything for me, and I was obsessed, as were most guys. You could talk to anybody who graduated from high school in the 70s, they're Bruce fans, because Bruce broke ground. Bruce came when we needed him, and I understand why if you or turned on to him in the 80s, you didn't quite understand what he meant to us older
guys.
But
also, I also kind of wonder, and this is no slight to anyone who is not an East Coaster, but I feel like a lot of his stories were like East Coast lore.
Yeah.
And if you weren't an East Coaster, I think maybe it was a little harder to find an inroad to all of the depth of what it was that he was saying. Now, I know that there are a lot of people who are not from the East Coast that are way into it, and I get it. But I think kind of telling those stories at that time that felt, you know, sort of that felt kind of, you know, intimate.
Yeah.
I felt like you know, being an East Coaster, you probably had a much better understanding.
Oh, I mean, I was aware of him and but it just, for some reason, it never hooked me. Like,
yeah.
For some reason. I'm,
no,
I'm
because
a big supporter of bands with black saxophone players.
Yeah.
Dave Matthews
My favorite band is the Dave Matthews Band, so
okay.
I enjoy that.
Yeah,
but for some reason I enjoy long jams. I'll sit down for 25 minutes while you do something.
Right,
I'll enjoy that. But for
that
some reason,
there's I, okay. Now you hit something that I really love, Dave Matthews, because to me, to go to you know, the Hollywood Bowl and have Dave Matthews jamming for like 4 hours when I have like, you know, a couple cocktails and, you know. And just hanging around, I could stay there for 10 hours. I love that kind
Thank
of jam.
The first I think you just found the first guest in 600 episodes who just bonded with Matt about Dave
to
Matthews
agree
Band.
With me about
Are you
the Dave
kidding
Matthews
me?
Band.
If you see Dave Matthews Band jam, it is true art. When it's, those guys go,
they're all so fucking good.
Yeah,
they're all so good at their instruments.
No, they're unbelievably good, and it's like what do you call it, the band from Vermont, what's the thing,
Fish.
Yeah, it's a Fish type thing where the more they go, the deeper they go, I guess, you know, the Dead type thing, but this is such a high energy and such a pleasantness. It's way better than listening to an album, I'm telling you. Like, you don't get it from listening to his album. To see him live is a whole different thing, and it just makes you feel happy to be alive. His live shows are spectacular.
So it's like Sting meets Parliament meets a pair of sandals.
No, it's fucking. Okay. I've seen him 46 times.
Yeah,
and there's like a year where I'm like, when they took that year off last year, I think, or the year before, they took the year off touring, and then
I remember how sad you were when that was announced.
Yeah, and they came back, and then I was like, am I still doing this? And I was like, I guess I'll do it. And then I went up to, where'd I go, Irvine? I went to Irvine.
We weren't tracking you at that point.
It was still so good.
No, it's
so
a great, good. It's a great thing. And it is a live thing, I think.
Yeah.
I've never heard an album of his where I could get that, what you get live. When you are seeing him live, it just,
Yeah, it's two different beasts. I feel like his he's a guy that like his songs aren't done until he's toured with them for 2 years. Mm. You know what I mean? Like he puts out the album and that's the skeleton, and then when he tours with it for 2 years, after that, then you're hearing that's how the song should be.
Yeah,
that's where he adds all the CG and puts Jabba in the
And Andy Serkis is in a mocap suit.
You get all the extended cuts.
Yeah,
yeah. You know, he got so big so fast. Also, that there was sort of a little maybe people just saying, you know, that's too much. They were playing too much of his stuff, but. For a while there, when he first broke, that was like 94.
94, yeah.
It was 94 because we did the first couple episodes of this show that I used to do called Singled Out at spring break in Lake Havasu for MTV. Mm-hmm. And the band who was on right before we did our show was the Dave Matthews Band. And I had lunch with them. And they were very sweet. And up to that point, they were sort of like, I don't want to say like... sort of like a college, like where they were known with at colleges. Like
they were big in the college. They were Northeast college.
They were the type.
They were in the college circuit. Mid Atlantic.
They were
out of Virginia, Charlottesville, and they worked all the way down, like from like North Carolina,
they were down to Atlanta. Yeah,
they were the Mid Atlantic college.
He basically the story behind
they got out to Boston.
The story behind him that I heard was that he sold shit tons of basically CDs out of his trunk, kind of a band.
Yeah.
You know, like they would just tour the colleges and sell a bunch, and that he had that, you know, like that was his
their first release. Remember Two Things?
Yeah,
which was an independent release, and then.
Yeah.
Under the Table and Dreaming is 20 years old this November, everybody.
Oh. Yeah,
as is Dumb and Dumber 1.
What?
No! That's,
how did that happen?
Isn't that weird? We're just letting it go where it wants to go.
How did that happen?
It comes right back.
Came right back to it.
Oh, wow. How did that happen?
But I'm not trying to get us back Dumb and Dumber 1 because I could talk about Dave Matthews. I was a convert because I didn't understand Dave Matthews till I saw him live.
Yeah.
And someone dragged me to it, and I was like, I like Dave Matthews. I didn't dislike him, but when I saw the show, I was a convert.
I got to get you over to one at some point.
It really is something else. It really is a very pleasant show to see. It's extremely nice.
It's great.
Yeah.
I will go with you
sometime
so that I can... try to better understand my friend's obsessions.
I would appreciate that.
Are you guys? You know what's a nice show? It's a completely different show, by the way. Nothing. The energy that he has is like crazy. I mean, and the musicianship is just nuts. But and this is like kind of a side. I'm going sideways because it's a completely different kind of show. But have you ever seen Jonathan Richman?
No, I've never seen him.
Okay, Jonathan Richman. He goes up just some guitar and he has a drummer.
He was in something about Mary.
He's the only guy I've ever seen he'll come to LA like once or twice a year and he'll play in front of like 200 people and 250, something like that. And he is the only guy I've ever watched who actually I well up watching.
Really?
Yeah, I get emotional because he's so...
He did the theme song to Foxwoods.
He's an artist. He's a poet. And his poetry is so beautiful, so simple. So simplistic. Like, what he talks about, let's like do a song about the corner store, and he talks about the corner store when he was a kid. And I swear, I get emotional listening to him. And it's a very low key, like, everybody's quiet. If no one's quiet, he'll stop. Excuse me, I'm singing over here. You know? Like, he has to have just complete silence. And he just has his drummer, Tommy Larkin, and himself. And You want to see a real, like, it's like kind of like it's like one of those, what do you call it? Like, what do you call live art shows? What are those
performance
called?
Art?
Performance art, almost. Only it's true, you know, he can write beautiful songs, but it's so different than anything you've seen. And that's one, like, if I sit back, go, well, I could just sit and listen to him sing all night long, but it's a completely different thing.
He probably plays at Largo, right? That's a couple hundred seats.
I feel like he's a troubadour guy, right? Where does he play when he comes down?
No, he wouldn't fill a troubadour. He goes to little places, like the smaller places,
like
offbeat places. And, you know, sometimes, like, I saw him in Santa Barbara last year. He played in front of, it must have been, like, 80 people. You know, I've seen him, I've probably seen him 20 times, but I've never been disappointed. I always get emotional, and I feel invigorated from him. He makes you glad to be alive. He's a real
Musical yoga.
Yeah, no, it's a beautiful thing seeing him. You just remember why you like music so much, because it's, and if you don't never heard one of his songs, it doesn't matter.
Yeah,
it, like I remember the first time I saw him, someone dragged me to. I knew one of his songs, Roadrunner, which he never plays, and but I sat there and I was like misty watching him.
Mm. Do you ever talk to him?
Yeah, I talked to him.
Can you you should convince him to put on a show?
He you mean come on here?
Yeah.
Are you kidding me? He'd come down tomorrow. He lives. You know what he does when he's not playing? This is a true artist. He, there was an article written in Rolling Stone. God, it's got to be 20, 25 years ago. You know, he was in Jonathan Richman, the Modern Lovers, back in the early 70s out of Boston. They worked at Spit, which is considered the first, pre-CBGB's, first punk club in the country. And he was just a guy that go up there, and he had his band, and they play. And the record companies came flying to him, and they said, you're the guy. You're the face. You're the one. He said, no, I don't want to do that. Like, what do you mean? That's not what I want to do. I don't want to be the guy. I just want to do what I do. Walked away from it, and they plucked guys. Like, what happened is a couple of guys from his band went to the Talking Heads,
mm-hmm.
Jerry Harrison, and then another guy went somewhere else, and then they, you know, the Talking Heads and you know, all those groups that took off then, Blondie, those guys, they looked up to him. He was a guy, and he just didn't want that, and he still doesn't want it. Like, I've called him up and, you know, tried to get him to do. He's just an iconoclast who follows his own, beat. And when he's not on the road, he is a bricklayer.
What?
He's a bricklayer. That's what he does.
Kind of brilliant.
Yeah, he's a bricklayer up in outside San Francisco, and he takes it very seriously. He loves making stone walls and all that kind of stuff. And that's what he does. And he's pure. He's That's totally great. Pure. He lives, you know, hand to mouth. He's never made a lot of money. He could. He could have done a lot of things to make money, but he doesn't care about money. Money means nothing to him. And by the way, he's a little socially funny. Like, when you meet him, he's a little like, he's got kind of a look like a guy who did a lot of acid mm-hmm. in the 60s. He's never done a drug in his life. He's had about 3 beers in his life. Because when I met him, I said, did you do a lot of drugs in the 60s? He says, no, I never did a drug. I said, come on. He says, I've never smoked a joint, never done anything. I said, really? He goes, no, I'm just.
How old is he?
Probably 62.
Is he really? Wow.
Yeah. Well, he was 21, 22 back in the early 70s. So, yeah, he's probably, you know, in his 60s. But he's an artist. He's the real deal. I mean, he's as pure as they come.
I like the idea of just brickwork.
Yeah.
Matt's been building stuff in his, first of all, he built a shed.
Yeah.
That he is now building other things in.
Oh, it's the best. Like the day, I had a day where I just had to paint the shed.
Yeah.
After we had 8 weeks of At Midnight, and then we finally had a week hiatus, and then my girlfriend left town on Friday, and then I just had the Saturday. I was like, oh, I got to paint the shed. And then I just went out there, didn't even have music on, and I just painted did 3 coats on the shed, 8x12 shed, and it was the most gratifying day of my life, because when I stopped, there was a painted shed.
Yeah.
There was just something about doing something where you can immediately see the gratification of that.
Yeah.
It's just like, and then I built a fireplace mantle over the week that I was off. I was like, I might as well.
Jonathan would come here in a heartbeat. Like I will happily reach out to him because, he does travel around here and there, and he would do it. But he doesn't seek things out. Like if I call him and said, hey, you got to go on the show. We were talking about you. They want you to come on. You know, come in and play your thing. I'm sure he would do it.
Oh, that'd be super fun. We'll go. We could do it in go to Swing House or something and record it in the studio. And have him play.
He doesn't need much room. He could do it right here. I'm telling you the truth. Like,
this is not the best room for this. The acoustics in this room are even bad for talking. I don't think they'd be really good for music.
Oh yeah, because of the brick.
He'd look at the brick, and first of all, he'd probably be able to tell you what was wrong with it.
Yeah. One time, I went to visit him in San Francisco, and I went up there with my wife and kids. We were going up, so we called him and we hooked up. And he goes through periodic times where he doesn't talk because he wants to save his voice.
Sure.
And so we were with him like a whole day, and he never said a word. He just wrote on pieces of paper and handed it to me the whole day.
Well, I hope he's not going through one of those when he comes on the podcast.
No, that would be annoying. Yeah.
Jonathan says, I don't want to talk because it's going to fuck up my voice.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So then but he'll sing.
But he'll sing. Yeah. Well, we'll have him on. Yeah, yeah, we'll absolutely have him on.
That'd be grand.
So how did it feel? Okay, so now that we've come full circle,
yeah,
how did it feel? And by the way, I enjoy that the theme of the podcast has been like pure, authentic, stable artist people who are true to themselves. Yeah. And have it's kind of nice. We've come around. We've hit a lot of good names.
And now here we are.
Yeah.
20 years later.
Yeah.
Pete, what did it feel like to get back onto the set with the guys?
Well, you know, people have asked me, like, how long did it take till they got it back? First take, first 5 seconds. It was instant. You know, they were both instantaneously back. And I literally mean the first take. They did the first take, and we all stopped and looked at each other like, yes. You know, it was so... It was like we had never left. They were immediately back to it and just off to the races. And also because, you know, we always have fun on our sets because we go out of our way to have fun because it should be fun. And we really like, you know, and I've probably talked about this before, but people say, you know, comedy's hard work. Well, we feel it shouldn't be. It should be really fun, happy work. And for guys to take chances in comedy, they have to feel really comfortable with the crowd.
Of course.
So we just make it a really happy, like, come on, let's go out and party feeling. And then and during the day, everybody's having a good time. And but this on this set, more than any, those two love each other. Jim and Jeff have a love for each other. And the reason they do is because Jeff is the most giving actor ever. All he does is think, how can I make this better for Jim? What does Jim need? He really does. Because Jim needs a lot of room. Jim tries lots of different things. And Jeff only reacts to Jim. So he wants Jim to be able to try all these things, and then he will react appropriately to each one. That's why you can watch Dumb and Dumber more than once, because one time you can watch it and you're seeing what Jim does, and then the next time you watch that same scene, but you see how Jeff reacts to what Jim does, and that's what makes it great. Like, I always think of the scene where they picked up Joe Mental hitchhiking in the first one, and they pull up, and Jim says, I don't know, we don't normally pick up hitchhikers, and Jeff's behind him, like, glaring at Joe Mental, you know, angry, and then Jim says, I got a good feeling. I got to take a chance on this one. And right on that, Jeff just goes smiley, like, yeah. He's whatever Jim thinks, he thinks. And that's how he treats it. So he knows he basically hands everything over to Jim, and Jim knows that Jeff does this. Jim knows that Jeff's allowing him to do what he does. And also, you know, so they have total respect for each other.
How is Kathleen Turner?
Fantastic. Like an old-time movie star. Like, just like you would hope she would be. Like, you know, comes in like, hey, darling, how you doing? You want to go see us get a martini? It's like, yeah, I would like to go get a martini. Great, I'll meet you down there in 20 minutes.
That's awesome.
Yeah. No, she was great. Like, I thought she'd be a little standoffish, you know. Not at all. She was like, hey, it's a Friday night. What are you guys doing? Let's get the hell out there. Seriously. Like, okay. We were thinking of doing something. Okay, pick me up in my room, 6:30. You know, she was just game for everything. We had fun. She was really a lot of laughs.
Yeah. And Rachel Melvin is coming on the podcast.
Oh, she's fantastic.
Who is fantastic. She's really funny.
Oh, she's great.
Really, really funny.
She was great, sweet, fun, the whole thing. We had never seen her before. I never heard of her. She's done a few things, apparently, but she came in and read and just knocked our socks off, which is great. We didn't know her. Nobody was pushing her. We weren't getting calls from agents saying, you got to hire this woman. You know, you get that to studio. This woman's good, you know. But she just came in and was the one. You know, that's her. You know, let's not fight it, you know. That's the one. So she was great, and she did a fantastic job. By the way, that's my least favorite part of making a movie is the actual casting. Because of that, like, you see, like, 50 or 60 or 100, you know, actors for one role, and there's going to be four or five that are neck and neck. Neck and neck. And then the good ones, you have come back once and then twice, and then you narrow it down. Then you're down to, like, three. And it's kind of like you could pick any of them, and it's always – the hard part is, you know, you can only pick one, and then 99 you didn't pick, and you feel bad because there's a lot of good ones out there. But yeah. she kind of stood out on this one.
And also, you can have people come in the room that you're really excited about, and then for whatever reason, it's just not there that day.
Yeah.
But that was the chance that
we try. You know, I've done, we haven't really done any TV, but I executive produced a show once, and I could not believe the process of...
What show was that?
It was called, what is it called? My brain shot. It was called, it wasn't
you know
my
what?
Show.
You cut
it was,
back on the Dave Matthews
no,
concerts.
It was called, it was back in the 80s, shit, I mean back in the 80s, back in the 80s, I mean back, I mean early this decade, back
Peter,
in,
I'm going to check your IMDb and tell you what show you executed.
Was it Manimal? Was it?
No, it was called,
Facts
you know,
of Life?
When they get cut, when they get like, you know, I block them out, you know, I don't live with the defeats, but it was only on for like half a year. And it had a fantastic cast. I had nothing to do with it, by the way. I
didn't Pete Farrelly's Fun Time Aussie Cocktail Hour?
Huh? Aussie and Drew? No. No. Executive producer. Come on, look. You know.
It's got to be in there somewhere.
It's there.
Even the internet.
TV show?
TV. Fox.
Unhitched?
Unhitched.
Oh.
Unhitched, yeah.
It is so, unhitched from your brain.
Unhitched the cast. We had quite a cast there, didn't we?
Yeah.
Who was in it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, we did.
Yeah, it's loading.
We had
Rashida Jones.
Yeah. Yeah, before Craig The Office.
Bierko. Craig Bierko.
Craig Bierko, who was hysterical.
Craig Bierko. Yeah. Pat Finn. Aaron Hayes. I know both of them. Very funny.
Well, we had some great people. In any case, the point of the story is, by the way, I should have remembered that. The reason I don't is because once something gets canceled, it's like, ging, I just don't live with it. You know, it's like gone, I move on. But in any case... So I couldn't believe the casting process for television. And this is what it is. You're in a room that's about twice this big. It's not big. This is a very small room we're in, I'll tell your listeners. And there are probably 40 people jammed into the room. And a lot of them are execs, studio execs, network execs, and their assistants. And they come in, and each actor comes in. Nobody says, "Hey, man, how you doing? You having a good day?"
There's no, it's talking. Like it's like walking into a meat locker.
Yeah,
it's
they come
freezing.
In and they literally come in and they say "go," and they do their scene and then they leave. And I literally saw this happen to two actors in a row. And then finally, I stood up. I said, "You guys can't be serious. This is how you do it?" They said, "Yeah." I said, "This is not a test of acting. It's a test of nerves." And that's what I would acting should be, because they're not going to always be this nervous. Why aren't you making them comfortable so you find out who the real good ones are?
Because they're afraid to... The thing is, I think the network people... A network person is a very specific kind of brain.
Yeah.
That never wants to go out on a limb to show anyone anything because they don't want to be responsible if someone's like, but I thought that one guy liked... Like, they don't want to... Yeah. So they basically just go stone-faced so that... They don't give anything away,
right.
Which sucks. And it's part of the reason why I hate the audition process so much, because it's not, you know.
It's not a fair, that's why they hire some of the wrong people. But when we cast a movie, I don't do that. People come in the room and I talk to them. Where are you from? What's going on? You know, really? Where you grew up in, you know, Oklahoma? Where did you go to school out there? Blah, blah, blah. I want them to relax, right? And then I tell them, I say, okay, we're going to try this. And then we're going to try it again after. So just relax. You're going to feel. I want you to feel comfortable about it. And then they do a take. And then I say, okay, let's try it again. Only this time, you started a little low energy. Let's come up a notch, you know, and take this. And then I say, you feel good about it.
Yeah, you're a director. Boom. You're directing them. That never happens in a room.
Well, I want them to have given their best shot.
Of course.
I don't want to be tricked into hiring somebody because they just have really good nerves. Nerves don't mean shit to me. I mean, I just want the talented ones. And most talented people are nervous people.
Yeah.
You know, they got nerves. So why would I not like want them to be like, you know, I do everything but give them a quaalude before they act. You know, I want them to be really relaxed and give their best shot.
Well, I started when I was still auditioning, I would go in and say, hey, I'm going to try this once, and if it sucks, just let me do it again.
Yeah.
And they would go, okay. Because you feel like you just have that one, and it starts very unnaturally, where you just have to go from 0 to 60 in half a second.
Right.
You're like, oh, we're in the scene now. Like, and I was never I was never good at that.
No, it's hard. It's really, and if you look at a lot of people who, like, a lot of people make it come in the side door. Like, I always think of, like, Owen Wilson. Imagine Owen Wilson if he had to, like, be reading or things. Like, you know, he didn't. What he did is he went and made his own thing. They made Bottle Rocket, you know, and they figured, we'll just shoot our own. Because, like, he would come in and you'd say, that guy's got kind of low energy, doesn't he?
Yeah. Hey, man, is it okay, like, if I do this again? Because,
My kids, by the way, go to this great school where they all the kids in the school get a freshman year. They get a horse, and they've been doing this since.
They get a what?
A horse.
A fucking horse.
A fucking horse.
A full sized horse.
Yes.
Like, not even a mini pony.
No, a horse.
He school, lives in Ojai, of course.
The school has horses, and all freshmen.
There's a horse budget.
Yes, and all they've been doing this since 1889. And the school, their whole thing is every freshman gets a horse, and you must take care of that horse every day of the year, freshman year. Saturdays and Sundays, you've got to be at school. We have to get up at 8 in the morning on Saturday morning. I get the kids there to feed the horses. Then back at 5 in the afternoon, at Sunday, every day of the year, except for when they're on vacation, school vacation. Plus, they get one weekend off per trimester where they could put the horse out to pasture.
Whatever happened to just giving a kid an egg and a diaper and saying, yeah, it's a baby?
Yeah. So they do this, and it's to teach, you know, responsibility, and you've got to keep the thing alive and make sure it eats and it's happy and all that stuff. So I was telling Owen Wilson this, and he goes, what are you thinking? He goes, a horse? You got them cleaning horse pee. Jesus Christ, no wonder the Chinese kids are running circles around us. He says, okay, so someone picks up horse shit and that's supposed to make him a better kid? Get him the hell out of there. But I think he was dead serious too.
And do you find that it works, or are there a percentage of horse deaths every year?
There's no horse deaths, but my kids are waking me up on Saturday morning at 7. Dad, get up, I gotta go feed the horse. You know, it definitely works. Definitely works. You know, it teaches responsibility. The kids are not just thinking about themselves, and it's only that 1 year, but it is the entire year of freshman year.
Wow! Yeah. And then the horses just get recycled.
Yeah,
the next
they get
year
recycled the next year.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah,
that's pretty cool.
It's a great thing. It's a great thing. It's an amazing thing.
I would call this episode Freshman Horse.
Yeah.
Wow.
If I could name it something,
I want to buy a horse.
And they have to ride the horses like 4 times a week, and it's not just feeding the horse and, you know, cleaning the stall, which they have to do. They muck the stalls every day. But they have to ride them, and they have to learn how to ride them. And this school is a crazy school. I mean, they have, like, they give guns in the school. They allow it.
What do you mean you have a gun? They have guns?
There's like a cowboy school. It's like a cowboy. Like,
oh, you're like shooting. You can't just like pack.
You're not walking around with a gun, but they have rifle practice and, you know, that kind of stuff. And it's. And it, by the way, this
is a Deadwood High.
It's not like a right wing school by any means. It's very progressive, actually. But it's a, like, you don't have to wear helmets, for instance, on the horses. I'm like, really? You guys get away with it? My kids have to wear helmets. I make them wear helmets.
Yeah.
But the school has no rules about wearing helmets. I'm like, you're shitting me. These guys are like, they're riding up in the mountains here. No helmets. We're not doing that. You know, like, it's a very.
Third semester homesteading.
Yeah. No. It's a great school.
Senior year train robbing and claim jumping. You have to wear a helmet if other kids are shooting at you on the horses,
yeah,
though.
Sure.
So they're trying to rob your horses. That's amazing. I want a horse. You want a horse. You think you want a horse, but then it will be. It's a lot of work, man.
I was talking about getting a horse with Mosier. Mosier and I were going to get a horse together.
What are you going to do with a horse?
We'll have a Phoebe horse.
Matt.
You'll have a what?
Now, God damn it. I see what happens with your guitar collection. I do not want you to start a horse collection.
Well, I mean, it'll be out there, like, and I can ride through Griffith Park on a horse.
I know you think you're going to do that, but you will not do that.
Yeah. I can put it in the shed. I'll build a shed for the horse.
You can't keep a fucking you can't keep a horse off La Brea. You can't.
That's what you think.
No. God damn it.
Yeah.
You know, one of the great lessons I got in my life, my father was, but he was a little, he could be harsh at times, but it was a good kind of harsh because it would, like, you knew, like, where you stood. And I try to teach this with I tell my wife this story because sometimes the kids will push and push. I don't know, maybe. I said, no, just say no. Let them know no so they can move on, get over it. And I remember when I wanted a horse, when I was a little kid, I was probably 7, 8 years old, and I was like dying to have a horse. And we lived in a little town where it was suburbia. Nobody had horses. You know, there was no barns. There was no farms. We had like half acre, you know. And I got it in my head. I wanted a horse. Dad, I want a horse. What do I have to do to get a horse? You can't get a horse, Pete. I said, come on, please. What if I take out the trash every day, do the thing? No, you're not getting a horse. And I said, well, what if I get straight A's? Straight A's, and I'll do this, and plus I'll mow the lawn every third day. You know, I was just trying to make deals, getting a horse. What do I have to do to get a horse? And finally one day I was begging for the horse, and my father said, Pete, you're never getting a fucking horse. Get over it. We don't live on a farm. You're never getting a fucking horse. You know what? I never thought about a horse again. That mid-second, I thought, okay,
Matt, what about you're a GoPro? Never getting a fucking horse.
No, it was over. I knew, yeah, I'm certainly not getting a horse. And I moved on to whatever it was. I want a go-kart or I want a baseball glove or something. But I remember that dream of having a horse, it was over.
It died that day.
And that's how you have to be with kids.
Pete, I got you this glove. It's made out of horse.
Yeah.
So you kind of got two things you wanted.
That kind of stuff. Like my wife hears that. She goes, God, he was a little harsh. I said, you know what? He did me a big favor. It knocked it right out of my head.
Well, now you kind of have a horse.
Yeah.
Or do you own any other horses?
No. We don't own horses. We're not horse people.
No.
Just the horses that
just
kids
during
get
the school year.
Yeah. The kids had never ridden. They just got there in that day. First day of school, they get their horse and they, you know, they don't ride, you know, they teach them and they do stuff.
What's the horse's name?
My daughter's horse has a horse this year, and the name is Tamalina.
Oh.
Yeah, Tamalina.
The horse.
And my son had name. Doc last year.
Oh, Doc's a good
and then,
that's
but,
a great
but
horse
then
name.
My son got hurt, not on the horse, he hurt his ankle, and then he got a shitty horse after that. and there's a couple kids who actually had donkeys. I swear.
Oh, if you're a bad kid, you get a donkey?
Well, it's like kids. Some kids are afraid of the horse, so they give them a little donkey to ride around on.
Oh, yeah. The donkey kids.
Yeah.
It's the equivalent of the short bus.
Yeah.
The burros.
The burros. You get the burros?
Yeah. I would take a donkey. Can I get a donkey?
No, man.
All right, fine.
You can't have a donkey. We're not getting...
Yeah.
I'd call this episode Dream Crusher.
Yeah.
Well, when your dreams are to own a large mammal that you have to spend a lot of work on. Matt, you complain about your schedule now. Do you understand that you would be adding a significant amount of time to the schedule that you already don't like to keep another creature alive?
Sure. You should hang around with my kids for a week and see what
don't
it
do that to them.
Oh, we would have so much fun.
It's a lot of work taking care of a horse.
Dad, I can't listen to another saxophone solo, please.
But
don't make me hang out with Matt again.
It's a horse. They love it because, you know, you love your horse. It's a big horse, you know, and they're...
If I hear the word Fender Strat one more time, I'm going to fucking... I want to pull my hair out, Dad. Please don't. Please.
Listen, me and the horses are going to be just fine.
Yeah.
I think it'd be really fun to watch you play an electric guitar riding a donkey, though.
I'll do it.
Not,
if I can keep
you
it.
You should not own the donkey, but...
Well, then, I'm not doing it.
All right, well, never mind then.
Fine.
I actually do have two donkeys. Miniature donkeys.
You do?
Yeah.
Well, it's weird that I said, do you have a horse, and that you didn't go,
No, because we don't ride them. You can't. They're too little. They're little donkeys.
What do you do with
miniature
them?
Miniature donkeys. They just hang around the yard.
What?
Oh yeah, no, they hang around. They're
but
like,
I just feel it's so funny that I was like, you go, no, we don't have any horses. And
well, we're
like
not
5 minutes
people.
Later. Oh yeah, you know we actually have two small donkeys.
Well, a horse is a big, huge animal that takes a lot of care. A donkey you leave in the field, and you
but that
feed
is
it
an odd thing to have. Like,
yeah,
to just have a donkey.
Yeah, yeah.
And
well,
it's
you know,
mildly related to
chickens,
to horse ownership.
We have
mildly.
All that. Yeah,
you
well, I'm glad I clarified it.
That's
now.
So crazy. So you have chickens?
Yeah.
And that just, those fuckers don't wake you up at like 5 o'clock in the morning every morning?
I sleep well, but they do wake some people up. Yeah. Like they can be a pain in the ass. But you get fresh eggs, you know, every day. You get your own eggs. It's free range. You know, they're walking around the yard and it's all good. So healthy
eggs.
Do
they lay the eggs in one place or just find them around
the
yard?
No, they have a little area where they go lay them and they'll all pop. You know, every day there's probably like 10, 12 eggs. And
oh my God.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
You so give they're them fresh, up. Like still warm out of the chicken.
Right out of the ass. And we wash them. You got to wash them, of course, you know, make sure you don't get anything. But, yeah. My kids sell them. You know, they sell them at the street corner.
Why are you making your kids sell eggs? You've done very well.
They make a my kids been working. I have my son working.
This is unbelievable. Your kids are basically ranch hands and selling their own.
I push my kids. My kids when they're my son when he's 14, he's 15 now, but he got a job, summer job, he's in a parking lot. I want my kids to work cuz I worked growing up, and it makes you feel good about yourself.
How gratifying was it right before the day before your son was entering this high school? And you got to flip it and say to him, son, you're getting a fucking horse.
Well, he was excited. No, he was excited, but he was also a little nervous because it was like they tell you, it's not like you're going to play with the horse a couple days a week. You're there every day, morning and night, feeding, cleaning, mucking, riding. You have to really take care of it. But that's why it's such a good school. The kids, they pick kids that will be able to handle it.
Well, the horse that you had to take care of every day for a while, Dumb and Dumber 2, is out. Is it the 7th?
14th.
The 14th.
Yes.
November 14th.
November 14th. And also, can I just do a quick plug for
PSA? Talk about
PSA.
You want.
Quick
please.
PSA. We're
please,
doing my,
you
my
want.
Brother and I are doing this quick thing. It's a, you know, there's a lot of problems in high school, pregnancy and, you know, all sorts of diseases and stuff like that. So we're trying to bring back the hand job.
Kids, are you doing a fundraiser for this?
It's a grassroots organization. Right now, it's just my brother and I.
Yep.
It's called Hand It Forward.
Okay, great. Perfect.
And then backward, and then forward, and back and forth, and back and forth.
Is that different than Hand Jobs Across America? A different organization?
That's a completely different thing. Ours is you just go to at Farrelly Brother Bros, you know, on Twitter, and we're going to be having things at the sororities, and you know, we've reached out to a few. We haven't got any responses yet, but we're just trying to.
I would think,
trying to help kids.
Well, I think it's good to build out the HJ community.
Yeah,
so I'm glad that someone's out there.
No, the movie opens on November 14th, and it's fun. You've seen it, you know. It's
I got a slogan for you. Ready?
Huh?
Keep it handy.
Hey, keep it handy. Yeah, I like
kids.
That.
Keep it handy.
We are looking for a handy. Yeah.
November 14th, Dumb and Dumber 2.
Yes, Dumb and Dumber 2.
Keep making hand job.
Yeah. But the hand job is a lost art.
It is.
Like, how the hell did that go out of style? You know?
I don't know, because I think
it would be around forever. But.
Yeah. What is up with
it's
that?
Just good. It's healthy is the thing. It's a good, healthy, you know, alternative to pregnancy.
Solo hand jobs have not gone out of style.
No, they're back in.
Actually, they are. Very much.
Yeah.
The internet really brought that back.
Right.
Yeah. With a vengeance.
Yeah.
P. Farrelly, it is always a pleasure to see you.
I love
seeing
you
guys.
You're
one of the nicest guys in this business.
Well, thanks, man.
I'm going to come up and see your crazy Dumb and Dumber.
Please
ranch.
Do. Yeah.
All right. Dumb and Dumber 2, T.O., you heard it here first, although some other news organizations tried to take credit for the exclusive story, but don't be fooled. It was broken here on the Nerdist podcast. You know why? Because Pete Farrelly is a guy who said, I'm going to break this story on your podcast. And you called up and you came on and you did it.
And that day I said, I'm going to invite you to come to the set. And
man of his word.
I did.
He is.
And and you're going to be hearing from Jonathan Richman.
Please.
Oh, that would be amazing.
Well, he won't call you because he would never do that. So I'm going to have to call you and say, hey, do you... I'll tell him
I got a brick job for him.
Do you really want him? Because he would come... By the way, when he comes down here, he literally asked me. He says, hey, you got any walls you need built?
That's
like,
amazing.
Oh, yeah. He would. If anybody needs something, he would come down and do it.
I'm thinking.
If anybody listening out there wants to have a great stone wall made by a true artist, Jonathan Richman would do it. That's what he does.
And then will he build the wall and then play in front of it?
Well, you have to pay him to play.
Yeah, that's fine.
Pay to play.
Pay to play.
Yeah.
Free to lay.
All right.
Yeah.
Enjoy your burro.
Okay.
Enjoy your tiny burro.
Oh, that's great.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Pete.
Yeah. That's fun.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.